Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ethan Frederick, a host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Salvador Salinas about his new book, Land, Liberty, and Water, Morelos After Zapata, 1920-1940. Hello, and welcome to the show, Salvador.
Hi, thank you for having me, Ethan.
I was wondering if you could begin the show by telling us a little bit about yourself and your work.
Sure. So I'm an assistant professor at the University of Houston downtown. I've been here for 4 or 5 years, and I completed my PhD at the University of Texas at Austin. And prior to that, I had completed a master's degree at Oxford University in Latin American Studies. And just a little bit about myself personally, I'm from North Carolina, and that's where I was born and raised, right outside of Charlotte. And my father's from Mexico, and my mother's from the United States. And my father was actually from Cuernavaca, Morelos. So that's where there's a little bit of personal connection to the region that I ended up writing the book on.
Well, that really leads into my next question, which is, how did you come to write about this book, as well as what the book is about?
Well, I was always familiar with Morelos, having traveled to Cuernavaca during the summers when I was a child. My grandparents lived there. But of course, you know, when I was young, I had no idea I'd end up writing a book about the region. And also, you know, when I was in high school, I worked on a dairy farm for several years as a teenager. And just working on the dairy farm, I think, exposed me to agriculture and rural life. And I really enjoyed it, but, you know, still didn't know this would be what I would end up studying. And it really wasn't until I was an undergraduate and I was taking the History of Mexico course. And the professor, of course, gave a lecture on the Mexican Revolution. And after class one day, I had a question and speaking to him after class. And I just asked him, you know, he had spoke about the Zapatistas. And I asked him, what happened in Morelos afterwards? And he didn't have really a good answer. And he basically said, we don't know exactly. There hasn't been any good historical studies based on archives on Morelos in the 1920s and 30s. And so, you know, a light bulb went off at that moment. And I was already thinking about going to graduate school. And by the time I began my master's program, the second year, of course, was dedicated to research and writing the thesis. And I had run it by my advisor at the time, Alan Knight. Would Morelos, a study of Morelos in the 1920s and 30s, be possible? And he thought it was a good idea and ended up writing the master's thesis just on politics in the 1920s. And I did a summer research a summer of research in, I think, 2006. And it was clear from that first summer of research that there was a lot of material on Morelos, more than I could, you know, I was just collecting material and there was more than I could actually review. And so for the master's thesis, so I had leftover documentation. And then by then, I was pretty sure I wanted to write the dissertation on Morelos. So when I got to Austin after 2008, continued to study Morelos and would go summers to collect more archival materials. And of course, spent about 7-8 months during my research year collecting more materials, expanded the study to also include the 1930s. And That was how the book came about, how the idea for the book came about.
Well, I think it can be really hard to pick an end date, but you have a nice, neat rebellion at the end of this time period to tie it up as well. So let's get into what the book is actually about, because it definitely gives readers a good account of what happens in Morelos after Zapata. So perhaps first, you could quickly summarize how Morelos experienced the revolution and who Zapata was for the rare listeners who maybe need a little brush up.
Sure. So Morelos was the center of the agrarian revolution, of the 1910 Mexican Revolution. It was a decade-long civil war. Close to upwards of a million people died in the conflict, and many migrated to the United States. So it was a very chaotic time period that transformed 20th century Mexico. And as I mentioned, Emiliano Zapata, he was from Morelos, and that was where some of the most intense agrarian upheaval had occurred. And Morelos itself was devastated by the fighting. Many villages were in ruins. The haciendas were in ruins. The state lost some two-fifths of its population. Some fled to Mexico City. Of course, many died in the fighting. And the fighting went on for 10 years. And Emiliano Zapata, he became a national figure in the 1910s and, very much the agrarian leader of the Mexican Revolution. And many of the causes and ideals he fought for spilled over into neighboring states as well. Many peasants revolted in the name of Zapata, calling themselves Zapatistas. And Zapata was killed in 1919 in a betrayal where he was lured into a hacienda and he was killed. And the Zapatista movement kind of splintered after that. And the fighting ended up coming to an end in 1920 with the revolt of Álvaro Obregón, who came to power in 1920. And Obregón comes to power in 1920. And, of course, he needed to make alliances. And he reached out to the Zapatistas, the ones that were remaining in the field still. And he promised them if they would... In exchange for supporting his government, he promised them the ability to carry out a land reform in the 1920s and 30s. And there's been things written about the land reform in Morelos in the 1920s and 30s, but just little bits and pieces here and there, a chapter here and there. And from my archival research trips, it was pretty clear that there was a lot of material that had not been touched in the archives. To cover the land reform in the 1920s and 30s. And in 1920, they basically start to reconstruct the world and put things back together. People who had fled to Mexico City from Morelos, they start to return to their villages, and they begin to literally reconstruct their communities. And land reform begins, and people start to flock to the region as well for the promise of land. And that was kind of an overview of how the 1920s started.
That background makes clear that there are many topics that historians need to be explored. Your book that manages to cover a whole lot of them, and it's just a crisp 174 pages, and it manages to explore education, state formation, water rights, forestry, agriculture. The breadth is really extraordinary. But your first chapter obviously talks about Pueblo politics. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
So I encountered an abundance of archival material in the archives and documents pertaining to politics in Morelos in the 1920s and 30s. And it was so much that I didn't know exactly what I wanted to focus on when it came to the politics. Did I want to focus on individual governors and their relationships with the Pueblo or their individual policies and elections? And as I started to write the chapter, and it was, as I mentioned, it was one of the longest it was one of the chapters that I worked the most on. And I decided that the best way to tell this story was to keep the narrative focused on the Pueblos and specifically their relationship with the state government and the federal government. And I felt like that helped to keep the first chapter cohesive without going out on tangents that didn't specifically keep the analysis on the Pueblos. And in the 1920s is when the agrarian reform began in Morelos. And the first governor from 1920 to 1923 was Jose Parres. And he had been a medic in the Zapatista army. And so he was a civilian and he was chosen to become the provisional governor in the early 1920s. And it was pretty clear from his governorship that there was going to be big problems between the Pueblos and the state government. And chief among those problems was, as the state governors, they wanted to build a loyal political clientele in the Pueblos. And the problem is they went about doing that using authoritarian means. And specifically, they would often impose their loyal supporters in municipal elections. And that caused all types of upheaval in the villages, because of course it was anti-democratic and it overrode village patriotism. And as soon as that began, those types of conflicts in the early 1920s, we see this pattern where the villagers would reach out to the federal government in their conflicts with these state governors. And they would petition and lobby the federal government to come down on their side against these some of these governors. And, you know, in the mid-1920s was a very chaotic period. There was six or seven interim and provisional governors that came and went during this very chaotic political period. And a lot of that was due to the pueblos petitioning and lobbying the federal government, complaining about these abuses, about them overriding elections. And the federal government would often intervene on the behalf of the pueblos. And so we see this relationship between the countryside and the federal government forming. And it was particularly over the pueblos' opposition to specific state governors in the 1920s. And over time, these bonds between the federal government and the rural communities they become stronger. And at the same time, the state government is weakened. And, you know, the Morelos state government, it being so close to Mexico City, has always been kind of overshadowed by the power of the federal government. And we see that occurring in the 1920s. And, you know, by the 1930s, the governors are still important, but they have to have a better relationship with the pueblos. If not, what we see is there will be political upheaval. And if there's some type of abuse that the governor is committing in rural communities, then the countryside reaches out to the federal government and asks them to intervene. And it was a pattern that was set in the 1920s. But over time, thankfully, by the 1930s, the state government kind of it learns how to govern rural Morelos, and specifically by respecting the outcomes of local elections. And that was how the federal government and state government were able to reassert authority over the countryside by respecting village sovereignty, as I elaborated on in the introduction.
One of the things that I really enjoy about this chapter is that you capture the whole story very clearly, but then another thing you do is not let the pueblos merge into this sort of homogenous mass of something like the people. Your book surveys the differences and divides both within communities and then between neighboring communities, and I think that's an intervention that I found really refreshing here and that a lot of Latin American history would benefit from.
Yes, so that was as one of the advantages about working on this topic was that many anthropologists had studied in Morelos. They had produced ethnographies, you know, going back as far as the 1920s with Robert Redfield living in the village of Tepoztlan in 1926 and 1927, and later with Oscar Lewis, who produced some well-known works on the study of Tepoztlan as well. And the anthropologists provided me the theory of how to think about these communities. And, you know, there was a big debate, and it goes beyond just Morelos in Mexico, but also includes studies of peasant communities in Africa and Asia. And many scholars have written about these rural communities as being these very cohesive, egalitarian rural communities where everybody, all the members of the community are working together in unison, and they're very skeptical of outsiders. And they redistribute surplus wealth among themselves. And these are kind of like portrayed as what I would just call the good pueblo, the well-behaved pueblo. And on the other hand, particularly from Oscar Lewis's study and others, the way anthropologists and other scholars have written about the pueblos is kind of from the opposite angle, is that, no, these are divided communities. And they're divided by economics and class and also by race. And rather than being these little democracies, instead they are fiefdoms of caciquismo, where one individual dominates the community, and it's anything but a cohesive community. So I had these two visions, and of these rural communities, and those visions helped me to make sense of village behaviors, why certain communities are acting in certain ways, and analyzed the abundant archival documentation of all these village conflicts, I began to see that there were different types of communities. And some were indeed cohesive communities that were able to control their resources, and there was not a lot of internal conflict, at least what I could tell from the documentation. While on the other hand, there were indeed communities that were racked by factionalism and divisions, and there would be sometimes many landless families in the community because the family that administered the village's lands was favoring their friends and family over others. And so I found both types of communities, and I tried to identify which ones were like that. And it was also important to be able to explain why was that the case? Why were these communities this way? And as I did that, it also became clear that these communities weren't static. They could change over time. And so, one community, for example, could be quite cohesive in the early 1920s, but the newcomers come throughout the decade and they migrate into the Pueblo. And by the 30s, the community is racked by divisions. And so I saw Pueblos evolving over time. In other words.
For the rest of the book, you do a great job of showing how the united and divided Pueblos navigated these sorts of issues. In your second chapter, you get into the forest usage and clearance in this time period. Could you tell us a little bit about about forestry and this chapter?
Sure. So chapter two was specifically on the land reform. And the forest became an important issue as well. Northern Morelos, Morelos is a small state, only about 5,000 square kilometers. But it's pretty impressive, the diverse range of its geography. And so in the north, you have the Ajusco Mountains, and very forested. And those communities in the north were a little bit different. They tended to be more indigenous communities in the north of the state. And then the big difference, though, was that they didn't practice commercial agriculture. Of course, they had mostly secondary lands, and they didn't have access to much irrigation water. So they grew mainly subsistence foods, such as corn and beans in the north. But also, as I mentioned in that chapter, what was important for the northern communities' ability to sustain themselves was exploitation of forest resources, and in particular, the expansion of charcoal production in Morelos in the 1920s. And historically, those northern communities had depended on seasonal work on sugar plantations in the lowlands, but the sugar plantations were in ruins, and it requires a lot of capital to build a sugar mill, capital that wasn't there in the 1920s and the early 1930s. So these communities in the north, they turned to producing charcoal in the forest. And I go into some detail about how charcoal is produced, and it was a very rudimentary way of producing charcoal. Basically, you make an oven in the forest, you chop down an oak tree, and you roast the wood. And it takes 24 to 48 hours and to roast the wood right there in the middle of the forest. And it being an environmental history, it was pretty clear that there was some deforestation going on as a result of this charcoal economy. And a lot of the bureaucrats from Mexico City that were visiting Morelos in the 1920s and 30s, they were usually complaining about how destructive the charcoal economy was. And, the biggest threat I found was just the danger of forest fires. Because if you have an oven there and you're roasting wood, if you abandon the oven, it could very easily catch fire and spread and create a forest fire. And so that was what was going on in the northern communities. And, of course, the heartland of Zapatismo is in the lowlands, in the where the old sugar plantations were. And that's where the irrigation waters are, the water that comes off the mountains and down through the rivers, and many spring waters as well at the base of the mountains. And so that's where commercial agriculture thrived. And I found in those communities, particularly that I focus on at the beginning of the second chapter, as the land reform is being carried out, the best in the early 20s and the mid 20s, the best lands were being redistributed, the irrigable fields where you could grow crops year round. I found a lot of conflicts between the ejidatarios, right, the ejidos that had been redistributed to these communities during these years, there was always a group of smallholders that held small ranches and small farms as private property in these communities, and those smallholders, they ended up being the ones who opposed the agrarian reform on the ground, because they, of course, felt threatened by the agrarian reform, and they felt that, you know, their lands would be taken and incorporated into ejidos. And this is also kind of part of this process of political centralization, because as these conflicts between the ejidatarios and the smallholders unfold, the smallholders tend to latch on to the municipal governments, the traditional municipal governments of these communities. There's about 30 municipalities in Morelos, and they dominate the municipal government and they dominate the elections. And on the other hand, the ejidatarios, they use the ejido and the institutions that go along with the ejido to form stronger alliances with national authorities in Mexico City in order to oppose the smallholders. So this is also how we see the federal government gaining a stronger hold in Morelos in the 1920s by these battles between the smallholders and the ejidatarios. And so there's a sweeping agrarian reform that's carried out in the 1920s. The haciendas system is dismantled. Many haciendas, they do hold on to some lands, but they're mainly secondary lands. Again, the best lands were being redistributed. And three-fourths of the peasantry had access to lands by 1930. So it was a sweeping agrarian reform. And neighboring states and campesinos, peasants from neighboring states, they were attracted to the promise of land in Morelos. So we see, particularly from the state of Guerrero, to the west of Morelos, many peasants start to move in to pueblos in Morelos, seeking land, particularly in the late 1920s and the early 1930s. And that tends to create tensions as well, because you have these newcomers, they want land, but they don't have access to it. And so by the mid-1930s, with the rise of Lázaro Cárdenas and the the years of the great national land reform in Morelos, a second phase of the agrarian reform is carried out. And many of the ejidos of the 1920s, they were extended later in the 1930s, so more people had access to land. And it wasn't the second phase of the agrarian reform wasn't nearly as sweeping and as impressive as the reform in the 1920s. But nonetheless, it did help facilitate these newcomers to the villages in Morelos gain access to lands. And the second phase of the agrarian reform goes on basically till about the end of Lázaro Cárdenas' presidency in 1940, when I end the study.
Then in your next chapter, you describe what these victorious ejidos do as a hydraulic revolution. And I really love this term because you use it to push back on the idea that campesinos just want to grow corn and beans and stay in their small towns. Could you tell us a little bit about this Zapatista hydraulic revolution and what it meant?
Sure. So water is a very important and kind of a new hot topic in the study of the agrarian reform in post-revolutionary Mexico. And thankfully, I had access to the Archivo Histórico del Agua in Mexico City. It's a water archive, and it opened in the 1990s, I believe, but it wasn't really cataloged until about a decade later. And when I went to first study in that archive, it ended up being just a fantastic facility. It was very easy to access resources, well cataloged, well organized. And that, of course, the whole archive just focused on water conflicts in the countryside. And when you read about the history of Morelos and the Zapatista Revolution, of course, the famous slogan is land and liberty. And you know, historians and anthropologists have written plenty about land conflicts before and during and after the Mexican Revolution. And so having all this access to these water conflicts really shed a lot of new light on these disputes that were going on in the countryside during these years. And it really helped me, I think, to draw out the most original aspects of the study. And water was significant for several reasons, as you mentioned. First, water and irrigation allowed you to grow crops year-round. And it, of course, allowed you to grow commercial crops. And previously it had been sugar in Morelos. And as I write about in the following chapter, it was the rice industry. And rice, of course, requires a lot of water. And so, that showed that these rural communities, you know, they didn't fight a revolution just to retreat to their fields and grow subsistence crops, but they were indeed open to commercial agriculture, specifically the production of rice. And they were also open to engaging the state over rice production, because later in the 1920s, the federal government the federal government seeks to regulate the sale of rice in Morelos. And I was just really impressed by all the original materials I was able to find on water in Morelos during these years. And the big theme coming out of these documents was just how much conflict there was over water. Of course, water is a shared resource, and it was very common during these years for the highland or the pueblos that are at a higher elevation to control the flow of water as it went southwards to the lower level elevation of communities. And of course, that created a whole host of conflicts. And when you have, you know, the small community of just 200 people is having its water taken by the, you know, the big municipality of 2,000 or 3,000 people upstream, you would have the small community reach out to the federal government for help and help in retaining control of their water. And so, again, this process of getting the federal government to play a stronger role in the allocation of natural resources was taking place through these water conflicts as well. And we see water conflicts as well between the hidatarios and the smallholders throughout Morelos also. And water was also significant because access to water and good irrigation works, it more than doubled the value of land. And you could grow crops year round, and specifically commercial crops. But also I found there was even some cases where they were growing, not many, but they were growing corn year round on the irrigable plots in Morelos.
Well, there are so many delicious examples in this chapter. My favorite is an example of a group of workers on Hacienda who receive land from the government, which is nominally the whole Zapatista dream, only to find out that the land is almost entirely worthless because of all the water for the Hacienda is being used up by neighboring pueblos who had successfully petitioned for water rights. And you've already previewed this, but this water becomes so important because of the rice culture that builds up in Chapter 4. Could you tell us a little bit about Morelos as the rice bowl of Mexico?
Traditionally, sugar had been grown in Morelos. All the studies of Porfirian Morelos before the revolution, of course, focus on sugar. But rice was also grown in Morelos before the revolution. And you know, both sugar and rice require quite a bit of irrigation and access to water. And so they kind of complement each other in that respect. And rice, as I learned through this study, a rice paddy actually fertilizes a field because water drains over it and it aerates the soil, and it helps to spread nutrients throughout the soil. And so rice was always there, but because the sugar mills had been destroyed in the 1910s during the fighting, by 1920 and throughout the 20s, of course, there was talk of reviving the sugar industry, but there just wasn't the capital to do so. And that is when we see the expansion of rice production in Morelos, because a rice mill is a lot cheaper than constructing a sugar mill. And we see communities throughout the region producing more and more rice. And rice was also a good crop to grow in Morelos, not only because there was abundant irrigation sources, but also because Morelos, even before the revolution, started to gain a reputation for having for producing a very high quality grain of rice. And it had won international awards even before the revolution. And so farmers and hidatarios, they were familiar with how to cultivate the crop by the time the 1920s rolls around. And one thing that was quite interesting as well is that, you know, I didn't find anybody coercing the pueblos to cultivate rice. It wasn't like the federal government had a specific program to stimulate the expansion of rice production. The federal government doesn't even get involved in the rice market until later in the 1920s. And so in other words, campesinos and these villagers, they were responding to high market prices because, of course, commodity prices in the 1920s were generally increasing. And that was definitely the case with rice. And so it again shows they were open to market forces and to commercial agriculture. And so it starts to spread the cultivation of rice in the 1920s and the 1930s. And you know, so much rice was being produced that we could call it a rice bowl that was being basically taking hold in Morelos during those years. And later in the 1920s, there was a problem with traditional creditors loaning out money to campesinos early in the agricultural season around February and March. So they'd have the tools and the credit they needed to establish a rice farm. But the problem was, and there was always complaints about these traditional creditors and merchants, how they would abuse their position to make money and off the campesinos and to speculate in the rice market. So they would advance money early in the year to the campesinos, and they would say, you know, I'm going to pay you X number of centavos for or pesos for X amount of rice that you deliver to me. Well, the problem was is that later in the during the harvest season, when the fall came, the value of rice was much higher. So the peasants were receiving a lower value for their rice crop than they would have otherwise. And so because of all these complaints and writing these villagers writing to the federal government over the abuses committed by these creditors, in about 1926, 1927, the federal government begins that it wants to cut out the rice middlemen, cut out the creditors, and it itself will issue credit to the campesinos to support the rice economy in Morelos. And the problem there is that 1927, 1928 are exactly precisely when commodity prices started to go down. And that was the case with rice. And so as the prices for rice went down, and just as the state gets involved in the rice economy, there started to be conflicts between the rice producers and the federal bank and the federal bureaucrats and agronomists over the prices of rice paid to the campesinos. And of course, the Great Depression hits. So these conflicts continue and through the early 1930s. And it's not till the mid late 1930s, when the price of rice goes back up, that the conflicts over rice prices between the federal government and villagers decreases.
Your next chapter gets into the latest and biggest conflict to occur in this period, the rebellion led by a man named Noodle and his family. Could you tell us a little bit about the Noodle Rebellion?
Sure. So his name was El Tallarin, which means the noodle. And supposedly that was his nickname because he was very thin and skinny. And that had just been his nickname since I think he was a child or a teenager. And he was from the rice country in Morelos in the lowlands. And he was the youngest of several brothers. And all of his, I think he had three or four older brothers, and they all had fought in the revolution. And he himself fought in the revolution, but he was quite young. He was a teenager during those years. And I believe all three of his brothers were also killed during the revolution. And later in the 1920s, I wasn't able to find too much about his life in the 1920s, except that he had settled down to produce rice. And and later he had moved to the southeastern part of Morelos. And by the mid-1930s, around 1934, there was a gubernatorial election. And the state government was starting to gain more authority and more power as time passed on. And there was, an abusive state governor in 1934. And there was a lot of reforms, of course, that were going on in Mexico during those years. There was a constitutional reform that started to promote socialist education, a more radical form of education in rural Mexico that included a lot of anti-religious, anti-Catholic messages. And in 1934, when his rebellion broke out, he had been campaigning, not for governor, but he had been supporting one of the opposition candidates to the presidency during that year. And the governor of Morelos at the time didn't like him for that. And there was some type of conflict during a religious holiday in his home, his community of Tepalcingo, where there was a shootout. And El Tallarin, Enrique Rodriguez, as his name was, he was forced to flee and go underground in 1934. And that was when he decided he was going to revolt, because the governor had it out for him. And so he goes underground and he revolts in 1934. And The revolt goes on for 4 years, and it wasn't, you know, a spectacularly large revolt. I think no more than probably 100, 150 of supporters with him and his guerrilla band at the time. But it was a thorn in the side for the national government. And El Tayarin gains his reputation in the newspapers for being, you know, this like kind of bandit or Robin Hood figure. And it seems to be, when you read the papers, it's like there's all this myth surrounding him. And historians had mentioned El Tayarin here and there in studies, but there wasn't a lot about him. And as I was doing archival research, I started to find bits and information about his rebellion and what was going on in the various archives I was consulting. And the big question with his revolt was, you know, why exactly was he revolting? Because he had his guerrilla band, 100, 150 supporters up in the mountains, and they were always carrying out guerrilla tactics. But he also had supporters in many communities throughout Morelos, and particularly parents of school children, where the children were attending the schools where the primary schools where they were teaching socialist education during these years, and these secular values that they were promoting in rural schools. And so the question was, what were the causes of this rebellion? Why exactly did he rebel? And I found a few reasons. Obviously, there was the political reason that he had revolted. He wasn't accepted by the national party that had started to form in the 1930s, the PNR, and the governor had it out for him. So there was some political reasons, but also he had cited socialist education in one of his manifestos when he revolted. And a lot of his supporters who start to oppose the federal government just at the ground level in the villages, they are also speaking out against this socialist education and this, you know, broadcasting atheistic values into rural communities. And, you know, there were cases that I found where teachers were killed because they were preaching these secular values in these communities. And so there was a religious component to his rebellion as well. And also, when he revolted in 1934, I found there was an agrarian component to his revolt, because this was right before the second phase of the agrarian reform had begun. And so you had agrarian tensions in communities with the landless population increasing. And the federal government, you know, when he revolts, the federal government, you know, it would even bureaucrats, they would write, you know, there's a need to accelerate the redistribution of lands in Morelos in order to undermine El Tayarin's rebellion. So there were some agrarian tensions in pueblos as well that contributed to his rebellion. So there was basically kind of three components. It was a political component to why he revolted, and a religious and agrarian component as well.
And then, of course, the chapter ends with Cardenas making enough changes and promises and compromises that the rebellion comes to an end. And with the end of the rebellion, this 20-year period of state permission that you've written about also comes to an end.
Yes, and you know, kind of interesting in his story as well was that he was up in the hills revolting El Tayarin for 4 years. And during those 4 years, of course, was a gubernatorial election. And his cousin wins the governorship in Morelos in 1938. And so that in many ways kind of offered him a way out, somebody he could trust surrendering to the federal government. And so when his cousin becomes governor, his cousin consults with Lázaro Cárdenas about giving El Tayarin an amnesty. And they send an uncle out to find El Tayarin in the mountains. And he was persuaded to give up his arms and to return to a life in the countryside. But he actually joins his cousin in his governorship. And I wasn't able to clarify exactly how he died. I know he died shortly after the rebellion. And supposedly it was from getting involved in some of the political clashes that his cousin in the governorship was involved in.
A fascinating rebel for a fascinating topic. Obviously, Land, Liberty, and Water is worth a read and a close study. Could you also tell us about what's next for you? What's the next topic you're working on?
Sure. So I am working more on the rice industry now in Mexico. And the rice chapter, the fourth chapter, it was the last one I wrote. There wasn't an archive that I found that, you know, just had everything on rice that I needed. And so over time, I was able to collect bits and pieces of information on the rice industry in Morelos. And very little has been written about rice in Mexico, if you compare it to other crops such as, you know, coffee or sugar or henequen. And that was the last chapter I wrote. And as I was writing it and researching more about it, there were a lot of big historiographical questions about the origins of rice cultivation in the Americas. And there's a big debate about that. And it really, you know, I started to look into the history of rice in Mexico, and there really wasn't a lot there. But everything you read about it is that rice had arrived with the conquistadors as early as 1519, 1520, when they arrived in Veracruz. There's references to them having a bag of rice as soon as they landed. And, you know, I found a little bit more about rice cultivation along the Gulf Coast during the colonial period. And I was able to identify some other regions in Mexico where rice has been produced. And so that's what I'm working on now, the history of the rice industry in Mexico. And not sure exactly the time frame of the study. Right now, I'm just reading as much secondary literature as I can and taking notes and brainstorming and putting together a grant proposal for a future project on it. And it might not just be a book or a research project on rice in Mexico, but perhaps maybe even rice in the America or in Latin America. Because as I learned about rice elsewhere in the Caribbean and places like Brazil and South America, there's works on rice and studies of it. But again, it's one of those crops that's surprisingly not been studied to the extent that other crops in the Americas have been.
And I'm excited to have you back on when that is completed to talk about that book. There's definitely a lot of literature on rice in the English-speaking world, but your chapter in this book is absolutely right that there's a gap on where rice culture came from and what it means in Mexican.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And so one of the questions I'm perhaps going to be looking at is not just rice production in the industry itself, but also consumption. And so that's when we get into kind of a food history as well and a cultural history also.
Well, that is very exciting. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me today about your book. And thank you, Salvador, and have a great day.
You too.